Very good. It's now 8 o'clock, and because of all the power of meditation, I don't need my glasses anymore. It's amazing. Somebody pinched my glasses on the way here, so they didn't need any cleaning. But I must admit that I see much better with dirty glasses than with no glasses at all. Whatever. And anyway, I always remember in that Kung Fu TV show I used to watch when I was a kid, that the master, who was always incredibly wise, was blind. Yeah, so there's certain sort of stereotypes, certain icons of religion that I always look up to. Like the blind master was one of them. One of the other ones, and this icon, it wasn't even Buddhist, it was actually Christian. But I always looked up to, actually with two people, I really looked up to, it was always being very kind and very wise. And one of them was so kind and so wise that, he lived for such a long time. In fact, he's still alive. And you see him, you probably see him if you go to a shopping centre this time of year. He's called Santa Claus. Very kind, very generous, and very...
fat.
I never said that. And very... he had what we call, not fat, but gravitas. He was a very rounded personality. And the other one, which I remember, I don't know if these sort of movies or TV series, was Friar Tuck in Robin Hood. Remember Friar Tuck? Robin Hood? No? Okay. But he was like similar. He was always really fat. Had a lot of gravitas. And he helped out Robin Hood righting wrongs in the community. I always remember after righting all the wrongs, then they'd have a big feast. So sometimes that's how I was conditioned. So what happens after you right all the wrongs? And I suppose I have a feast every day. Because people are so kind. But anyway, for the talk this evening. Hey, I can see you. But you know, sometimes it's okay, you can see things. Sometimes it means you can read things. When I start reading sometimes, you know, you read some articles, and you can't say that, that's not right. So, you know, sometimes it's much calmer when you take your glasses off. So, all those senses... this was what hearing sense. There was a story I read so many years ago, and it did kind of change much of how I looked at life, what you're doing with your life. Sometimes people are helping, but are you really helping? And this was the story of a young boy. He was born deaf. He couldn't hear anything. And when he was about 6 or 7, his parents took him to the doctor, the annual checkup. And he checked, he seemed to be otherwise healthy enough, a happy little kid, but he was deaf. And so the doctor said he'd just been reading up in one of the magazines or medical journals that a new procedure had been experimented with for children like your child. And in about 10% of cases, they could actually restore hearing. It's only 10%. Now, the odds were against him, but it wasn't very intrusive and it wasn't sort of painful or anything. Do you want to give it a go? Now, the interesting point was they never asked the kid, they asked the parents. And the kid was just looking, sitting there, couldn't hear a thing. But anyway, they said, well, why not? So they gave him this little operation, and afterwards the kid could hear. He was one of the 10% who could hear. And that's when the trouble started. He said, why didn't you ask me first? I got now all this noise going on between, on these things on the end of my head. And I would much prefer it if you hadn't have done that. My other four senses were getting so so sensitive and exploring the world for those. If you'd really asked me, I'd have said, give me another hand, a third hand, because that's what I found more useful to explore the world. And sometimes there's two things I learned from that. One is, don't just assume that you know best, that you know you can help somebody when you don't even ask them. And secondly, that sometimes we always think the senses are wonderful, to have clear senses, to have glasses which make you see much more clearly. But then, what's there left to see in the world for a monk? What do you want to see? This is one of the things that I love questioning these things. And when I question them, we come across some wonderful answers. That time when, again, I think I mentioned this earlier, when we went on a pilgrimage over to India, and part of that, just on the way back to India, actually one nice thing which happened in India, I must admit, I always heard, and I do research first of all, find out what's there, I always heard that in the National Museum in India, there is some Buddha relics, the real ones. Because there's always controversy when people do excavating and try and find out, you know, when they dig up these ancient monuments, and you know, what is this? Is this a real Buddhist monument or what is it? And the history behind this, if you don't know it, but after the Buddha, when he passed away, they did the cremation. And before the Buddha actually died, he told them what to do. And he said, split the relics into eight parts and spread it to different parts of India. And especially to places where, you know, he went a lot. And so that's what they tried to do. But those eight parts, one of them, obviously, was his birthplace, Kapalavatu. And no one really knows what happened, but the many histories say that shortly after the Buddha passed away, the Sakyans at Kapalavatu, they were a very proud nation, and they, you know, did some diplomatic gaffe between the neighbouring kingdom, and they basically married the person who was going to become the king to a slave girl they had there. And when he found out he'd been tricked, he was so upset that he attacked Kapalavatu and destroyed it. So those are some of the myths at the time. But if that was the case, then the stupa at Kapalavatu, which had the Buddha's ashes, that would have not been destroyed later on by Asoka, because Asoka went to all the stupas, opened them up, and just divided the relics even further afield. But by that time, the Emperor Asoka would not have known where that stupa was, because the town had been destroyed. And even these days, that many times that people argue which one is the real Lumbini. Sorry, the real Kapalavatu. But anyway, that eventually these archaeologists, they found sort of a reliquary, and there was like a little box. And on the outside it was like a Sanskrit inscription. And there was two ways to read the inscription. Either these are the relics of the Buddha, or in this place are the relics of the Buddha. And because of that, the person who first found them thought, oh yeah, these are the real relics. And you know, but what it really meant is, are the relics in this place are the relics of the Buddha. It wasn't in the box, because another archaeologist, it was an Englishman, found those relics, but it was one of the Indian historians who dug a little bit deeper, understood Sanskrit partly much better than the English did, and dug a bit deeper, and there found the real ashes. And those are the ashes which are in the museum in New Delhi. And I thought, well, I did the reading, and said, this is almost definitely are the relics. And so it was wonderful again. So when you go to these places, you go and search around. It's like, again, not much excitement you have for a monk, but then you search around. There's no sort of guidebooks or anything. Search here, search there. And then you saw them at the end of a nice chamber. And the wonderful thing about them It was actually the king of Thailand just made a nice reliquary to display them. But the Indians wouldn't let them go anywhere else. They were going to stay in New Delhi. I remember going to see them. That they were so beautiful. And you could actually see them instead of just them being in a big tower somewhere where you couldn't really view them. And so that's where they still are. And for this one, I say, well done, India, for not sort of hiding it away, but actually letting people see it and worship it, whatever you wish to do. And I must admit, those relics in India, they really look like the remains of a burnt body. Because, you know, in Thailand many times we did cremations. But anyway, going back to... I always like wandering off, because I've only got a certain amount of tales, and I didn't want the talk to end too early, so I filled it up with a talk here and a bit there. And then also, just beforehand, going to the Taj Mahal and just seeing that. And I was always wondering, yeah, you are rebellious. And people say that's one of the wonders of the world, the Taj Mahal. It's beautiful. But I was just standing there, why? Why is it beautiful? Why do people say it's just a lovely place to go? Or is it just everyone's following other people like sheep? Oh, it's wonderful, it's beautiful. And if you spend so much money and effort getting there, oh yeah, it's very beautiful, it's very wonderful. And you know why? But then afterwards, I'm just looking at it. What is beauty? Really, is it sort of what we add to reality? Or is it something else? And it's an important thing to know, because we spend so much time searching for beauty, owning beauty, and getting in trouble because we own beauty and somebody else wants it and want to steal it. And even like people's jewellery. I also remember that time when Ajahn Chah was two of his disciples, and they used to follow us. I wouldn't really call them disciples, but they were having a separation, divorce in Thailand. And they were having this big argument about how they would especially value the jewellery and how to distribute it so it's a fair distribution of all that they owned. And they argued, said, well, this is my jewellery. You know, guys don't wear jewellery like this. Said the wife, I said, no, but I bought it, so, you know, I have a fair share of it. And so they had this argument, and Ajahn Chah said, let me see it. And so he got all this jewellery, I don't know how much it was worth, and he threw it in the fire. It's only stones. Oh, what's the big point? Which is more valuable, your harmony and peace, or these old stones which are now in the forest somewhere? Which is more valuable? He made a great point. That's one of the nice things with the Ajahn Chah. He wasn't just teaching with his mouth. He would often do such really innovative teachings, which you never forget. Yes, they weren't in the suttas, but they could have been, because what they said was amazing. Oh, this has just come into my head, and it's a beautiful one. You're probably expecting this. About these monks who were with Ajahn Chah, and I was one of those monks in the back seat of a car. We're going to the train station in Warin Chamrap, that's the Ubon train station. And there was a driver, Ajahn Chah, and three Western monks in the back. And the monk who I was sitting next to, poor fellow, he was actually a novice monk, and his name was Gary. I felt so sorry for him afterwards. He's a nice man. But then Ajahn Chah suddenly turned around and looked at Gary. He was American. And he said, now you're thinking about your girlfriend back in LA, aren't you? He'd only ordained for about 4 or 5 months. And this poor Gary, oh, his face dropped. Ajahn Chah had, what they say, nailed him, got it right first time. That's why it's very careful what you think when you are in the presence of monks like an Ajahn Chah who can read your minds. He felt sorry for him because... Anyway, so Gary said, yes. And then Ajahn says, oh, don't worry about that. You know, out of compassion, we can fix that for you. He goes, how? He said, oh, very simple. He said, you know, do you write to your girlfriend back in LA? Supposed to be an ex-girlfriend, but he still had feelings for her. He said, yeah. Well, next time you write to her, send her a request. And the request is, you know, you still miss her. So can she send you something of hers, something personal, something just, you know, which you can get it out when you feel lonely, and it reminds you of her. Yeah, in the old days, that people used to say, like a lock of hair or in a piece of your dress with another scent on it. Something like that. That's what. And I said, is that allowed? And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And honestly, after a while, when Ajahn Chah was saying things like that, which didn't make any sense at all, you knew he was up to something. It was wonderful, because he had this amazing way of teaching the Dhamma right to the point, which you'd never forget. Is it overlapping? Oh, yeah, 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 you can do that. But just ask her, not for, you know, the normal stuff, you know, ask her to send you a little bottle about this big of her feces. So every time you miss her, you can open up. That's my girlfriend. Back in the life. When you fall in love, don't you say, I love everything about you, my darling. No, that's an unforgettable double. Why is it that when we think of someone, we miss them, we always think of the beautiful part of them, not just of the negative part of them. He never did it. What a wonderful thing to do. So anyway, that was just, you know, using innovation to teach the Dhamma in a brilliant way so you see things properly. Now, I did think, oh my goodness, what am I going to talk about today? So one thing I haven't really focused on too much yet is how we use insight, understanding, to actually to solve problems. And that was a great example of that. You know, it was unconventional wisdom, you know, to realize whoever you love, it may be your boyfriend somewhere, and just, that's what you do, you ask him for a bit of his feces. So you don't just make fantasies out of, you know, what should really be just honestly just what is truth. Oh, I'm sorry, just these stories keep coming up. This is the story of some time ago. There were these two Thai ladies came to see me for counselling many, many years ago now. They were sisters. And a long time ago, that one of them had a husband, the other one was unmarried. And the one who had a husband was having a lot of difficulties with him. It was basically just cultural misunderstandings between them. One was born in Thailand, grew up in Thailand, the other one was Aussie. And she said, oh, it's just so difficult, you know, what should I do? And I gave her some teachings, like two bad bricks in a wall or something. And, you know, no one's perfect, you know, you're probably as bad as he is. But anyway, isn't it true? Just going a little bit on a tangent again. This Singapore lady, oh, she's really wise. Remember, she's saying that when she first got married, her father took aside her new husband to give him some advice. And he said, you probably love my daughter very much. And apparently he said something like, oh, there, she's so beautiful, she's so wonderful. I'm such a lucky guy to have married a woman like that. Even the way she picks her nose is just so charming. Anything you do. And the husband said, yeah, yeah, yeah. The father-in-law said, yeah, 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 that's what it's like when you first get married. But he said, I want you to remember this. After one or two years of marriage, you start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. You can't see them now, but one or two years, you start to see the faults and defects in her. When you start to see the faults and defects in her, please remember that if she didn't have those faults and defects to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you. And that was the advice which he never forgot. And so, yeah. You know, she's not perfect, but then neither am I. So, that's of wisdom. Realism is where we learn how to find some peace in our life. That's the function of wisdom, is actually to create peace, to solve problems, to settle things down. And you know, they have a word in Pali, if there is some unfinished business, you know, there's a problem, someone's accused of doing something wrong, you've got to find out whether it's true or not and how to settle the matter. Whether it's legally, whether it's in business, whether it's in life, whether it's just finding out where the leak is, where all the water disappears to. Once you find that, they call that settling the problem. And the word for settling the problem is called samatha. I love that translation. You know, sometimes we think samatha just means I'm getting very peaceful into jhanas. Yeah, it does mean that as well. But it means when the problem is settled, when wisdom, obviously, mostly solves the problem, then you get very, very peaceful. That is a sign of wisdom. That's its purpose, to create peace in our world, peace in our Buddhist society, peace in your mind and your family. So a little bit later, we use that wisdom. But sometimes, how does wisdom actually arise? And the worst thing to try and find wisdom is thinking too much. You should have tried that enough by now in your life. Thinking. Try and get a solution. It does work, you know. Though if I think a lot, I get a solution. But then other people don't agree with me because they think and they get their solution. And somebody else thinks and they get their solution. We all got different solutions. Why? We're thinking too much. Human beings are like that. You all know the story of the elephants and the seven blind men. But how many of you know the story of the seven blind elephants? You know that story? You know the seven blind men and the elephant. That's a standard story. But there's seven blind elephants were meeting together one day and they said, man, what was a man? Now, don't think, why can't we make that gender neutral? I'll tell you in a moment why we don't make that gender neutral. Man, what is a man? And they thought they were wise, these blind elephants, and they thought, I know what. Let's go and find a man each. Even though they were blind, they could hear and they could sort of sense when there was a man around. So let's go and find a man each. And let's feel it for ourselves, our personal experience. Feel the elephant, feel the man, because we're blind, we can't see. Once we've felt it, then we can come back and compare notes. That's what they did. They all found a man each, and they felt it. And after they felt the man, and they came back, you know, they all agreed that a man was flat. Anyway, that's not wisdom which makes peace in the world. Instead, we sometimes think in the whole of your life, you never find a person who totally agrees with you with everything which you think and see. Your experiences are different, interpretations are different. So why can't we just acknowledge every human being, every animal, every being in this planet or elsewhere all have these different experiences of life, and we accumulate those experiences. And sometimes we think that that is wisdom, that's the truth, the ultimate truth. It means we're always going to have arguments. It was something which I always was, again, concerned with, but also interested with. Why do so many people have so many different opinions? Why do they think so differently? Why can't they all agree that I'm right? Everyone else is wrong. Of course, that's ridiculous. That's arrogance. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, someone like an Ajahn Chah, when we... this is actually comes from an earlier story, from a Zen story. That these two monks... Actually, they call it a Theravada story. These two monks were having an argument about the importance of reincarnation. Now, rebirth, do you really need to believe in rebirth? And so one of the monks says, look, the Buddha taught rebirth. She knows. The Buddha taught rebirth, said one of the monks. It's in the suttas. You've got the whole idea of being a monk or becoming enlightened is to end rebirth. Of course, rebirth is fundamental. And monk number two said, but we have to live in the present moment. Now is the only truth. The past, as I said, is a dream. Sometimes we just mistake the past, and that's the future. It hasn't happened yet, so who knows? And so the monk said, no, real meditating monks, we live in the present moment, so you know, who knows? The other monk said, no, it's in the suttas. They had an argument. So one of them said, to settle this, we're going to see the master, see the teacher. So they went. One of them went in there first of all, they went in there one at a time, and they said, no, belief in reincarnation is in the suttas. We have to do that. And the head monk said, yeah, that's right. And he went out and told his friend, see, the boss said I was right. And they couldn't have done that. So the second monk went in there and told the boss, the head monk, said, no, you've got to live in the present moment. We haven't died yet. Who knows? And I said, oh, yeah, that's true. And then the second monk went out and said, he'd said I was right. He couldn't have. He said I was right. And had another argument. Let's go in there together. So they went in there together, and the first one said, you know, just belief in reincarnation is in the suttas, and you said I was right. And then this monk said, you've got to live in the present moment, so who knows? And so you said that was right. You can't say that we were both right. And the head monk said, yes, that's right. And I love little stories like that because it stops you trying to find the ultimate truth. And instead, doesn't really worry at all about that. So just leave that alone. Real wisdom is not to create more arguments and more divisions and more problems to fix later on. Real insight is to solve problems, to settle things. And that is another reason why, you know, it's wonderful in that sense that we come to a place like Australia and it's a multicultural society here. And I already mentioned this, you know, how you could talk about bowing to a Buddha statue, what the heck does that mean? And make it useful. You know, so other people can bow to that Buddha statue without necessarily being Buddhists, and they realize what you are worshipping and what you're developing inside of yourself and encouraging others to develop is that beautiful virtue, peace and kindness. You can't go wrong with that. So, but also, there was this time that I meant to mention this story, because when I mentioned the story of Father Frank Brennan, he was the chaplain at Christchurch Grammar School here in Perth. There was also another man of a similar name, Frank Sheehan. I might have got them mixed up again, I don't know. But the Frank Sheehan, he was a Jesuit priest and very, very intellectual, one of the top intellectuals here in Australia. Because I remember he was asked by the Prime Minister, the government of the time, to chair a commission to have a human rights addition to the Australian Constitution. So, now this was a really intellectual high flyer. And at a chaplaincy conference in UWA, where I was giving a talk, That's when, at the question time, he put his hand up to ask a question. I knew who he was, and I knew that at this time, Ajahn Brahm, no jokes. This is a very high-flying intellectual. So he asked me, and this was in chaplaincy, said, "What is the Buddhist idea of God?" And I no preparation at all, and I didn't know what he was going to ask. But anyway, it's very easy. One solution is to say, well, we don't believe in a creator God. There's no creator God in Buddhism. But you know, I realised that wouldn't really get you anywhere. You would say, I don't agree. And then we'd have an argument or something, blah, blah, blah. And it never took the discussion further. And one thing which is really important in a place like a chaplaincy is to be able to understand one another and to get some harmony together in this world. It's already too many arguments and violence in this world. So anyway, that I was sitting next to the old abbot of New Norcia Monastery. He was called Abbot Placid, and had a lot of fun with him. I understood Abbot Placid, because he understood me. He was a bit wary of me, because once when I went to the New Norcia Temple, and he took me around, it's very old buildings in there, New Norcia, some of the oldest buildings in Australia. And when we went through there, there's old wood, really spooky. And I said to him, are there any ghosts in your monastery? And he looked at me and said, "No, in the Catholic religion, we don't believe in ghosts." He took the bait, and then I pounced on him. I said, "What about the Holy Ghost?" He kind of had a conversation with you, but he laughed. So anyway, going back to, he was sitting next to me. And one of the things which he said at the time to me, many times when we were discussing, open up, how do you feel about Buddhism? How do you feel about religion? How do you feel about all these things which sometimes we can disagree with? And he said that one of his core beliefs, which drove him through his life, was, his belief was everybody is searching for God. Now, I could just say, oh, that's ridiculous, I'm not searching for God. But then, that was not going to take anything deeper. So then I said, look, he's a friend, I respect him. Don't always agree with him, but I respect him. And so when he says that, I said, all of you here on this retreat, what are you searching for? You like jhanas, wisdom, forgiveness, overcoming problems in life, feeling that you're not rejected, that you're respected, you're cared for. And it's not just what you're receiving, it's what the ability to give that to others as well. The ability to care for somebody else. The ability to serve. It's something I never understood for many years. It doesn't matter if you need any more food. If somebody needs to give it to you, you take it. I've often said, and this is true, my stomach doesn't belong to me, it belongs to you. And sometimes you put too much in there, it's not my fault. And you know, that's not an excuse, honestly. It's to try and give some happiness to people. They want to serve you. What was it? Look, is it cold? It's not really in the cold season now. But how many of you have ever seen me wearing socks? It has been really cold for me to wear socks. Even, when I was a student in England during the winter time, I wouldn't wear socks. I'd wear thongs and just bare feet. I felt much more comfortable. So I've got very good circulation, good metabolism. So do I never wear socks. But then, one evening at Nolamara Temple, this old Sri Lankan lady, I remember Lakshman? Lakshmi, yeah. Lakshmi's a guy. Lakshmi, she She, one evening she came out and said, "Ajahn Brahm, I've knitted you some socks. I knitted them myself. Please accept them." And of course, she's an old lady. She's been very kind all her life. And so I said, "Okay, I'll accept them." So I accepted them. And then we all went into the hall. And before I went into the hall, I went to the toilet and put on the socks. They're very uncomfortable for me. But nevertheless, I put them on. And I was giving the talk there on the Friday night, giving the talk there, just like I so usually do, you can't see my feet. And as I was giving the talk, I was moving around and talk about kindness. And then as I was giving the talk, I put my foot out with the sock on. And old Lakshmi, she turned to her friend, "He's wearing my sock," she said. Now to me that is wisdom and happiness, spirituality, it doesn't matter what religion you call it. That's a wise thing to do. So anyway, with old Amapasa, so everyone is, "What are you searching for? You know, what do you want in life?" And so in the end I told Father Frank Sheehan, Brennan, or whatever his name was, I told him that, well, personally, I don't seek for, what do I seek for? I seek for peace in the world, for kindness. I seek for happiness, for fulfillment, for fairness. At that time, I think we're still building Dhammasava Monastery. Those are the things which I seek for, and I know all the ones over here, what you seek for. You know, one of the big things you seek for is respect. People respect you and understand you're trying your best. Sometimes you fail, but a lot of times you don't really mean to harm, hurt people, and you regret it afterwards. We do search for respect and understanding, an ability to feel the kindness of somebody else and to give that kindness to others. We feel we're searching for any means or ways to make this world a better place, a kinder place. Because that kindness, harmony, that is the real beauty. You don't see that in the Taj Mahal. You see that in the people looking after one another, caring for one another, being at peace with one another. Sometimes you're very, very hungry and somebody just stops and gives you something to eat. Those are the things which people search for. And so then I said, well, all these things which, as Buddhists, people search for, and my friend over here says everyone searches for God, I put those two together. I said, well, that is God, if you want to say that. Not a being, not a person, but the sort of things which you respect. Kindness, peace, service, happiness, even health. And I was really pleased with that. Even in fact, she said, oh yeah, that's very good, I can use that. So, in other words, it was taking the spiritual debate deeper into places where we can agree and be at peace. Taking it further than things which divide us. Taking it into places where we can see solutions. And it means more people are actually searching for what is really valuable, rather than ideals and thoughts. And that gets you onto understanding that all those things which I was talking about are not ideas or theories, they're emotions. And I always said that this is like the emotional world of truth. So you don't argue with them and don't try and put it into words, because trying to put it into words is such an approximation. And sometimes you get the wrong words and it all falls apart. And it becomes blasphemy or heresy. Oh, you can't do that, you can't say that. But you know, in the end, even actually at the time when I did that first Bhikkhuni ordination over here, then, you know, I knew my Pali, I knew that it was allowed, it was okay, nothing wrong with it. But I also knew that emotionally it felt good. It's a good thing to do, to open up the monastic life in Theravada to women. Why on earth not? You felt it. And much of the time, whenever there is a moral dilemma, which in my position you have to face often, Then how do you solve that dilemma? And a lot of the time it's not by thinking it out, but feeling it out. This doesn't feel right, or this feels, yes, I have to do this. I don't know why, but I can't resist it. And it reminded me of one of the stories from my life, only what I read. And of course, there's many Vietnamese here, and you may have your own stories from the Vietnam War. But one of the terrible, terrible, terrible tragedies of that war was what they called the My Lai Massacre. It was a village, I forget exactly where in Vietnam it was during the Vietnam War, a village which a group of US troops were ordered to enter and to kill every man, woman and child in that village. That was the order. It was supposed to be a hotbed of the Viet Cong. But that was the order. And now to this day, I still remember the commanding officer in charge of those troops was called Lieutenant Kelly. But what I never knew, that there was media was with them at the time, and that's where the whole thing blew up, and just realizing that this was atrocities done by the US Army. And the full story, though, is always these parts of it which are really fascinating, wonderful. And that was some journalist, 25 years later, decided to try and track as many of those soldiers as possible and to interview them after 25 years, see what they were and how they thought. And the amazing thing, it was on the TV, I never saw that, but people came and told me about it, and I thought, wow, this is really great. Very interesting what happens when people do such things. And he said all those soldiers, nearly all of them, they all had very strong emotional problems. They had couldn't have a relationship, drunk, drugs, sick with cancers and stuff. The outcome of that, the karma, if you like, was terrible. But there's always exceptions, and it's the exceptions which are the interesting ones. He said there was one ex-soldier there. He was Afro-American. And he said he joined the military. He volunteered because it's a way out of poverty for him, a way to get an income, a livelihood, a training, respect, to survive. Otherwise, he was in the ghettos. And so he joined the military. And when he was ordered to go into battle against people with no weapons and kill every man, woman and child, he said, I can't do this. This is wrong. I can't. And even though he knew the consequences, where it took 2 or 3 years in military jail, and the jails in the United States are much harsher than the jails over here, and the military jails are even worse than the ordinary jails. It's like going to hell for 2 or 3 years. He knew that was a choice. Go to jail, military jail, or go in there and kill kids. And he took his choice. He went to jail. And he said, I'll never regret that, ever. And he was the one person who stood out. He had his respect, self-respect, his inner strength. And he said, how can you make a decision like that? You know, did you go to university and do a degree in ethics? He says, no, I was just from the street. I don't think I finished school. And are you religious? He said, no, he wasn't religious. He just believed in his heart. He said, that what told me that this was the wrong thing to do. And I couldn't do it, so I didn't. And I took the consequences. It says, when you look at 2 years in a jail compared to just a lifetime of staying with that remorse, which is the lesser? So it's the 2 or 3 years in jail. He's a very strong, wonderful human being now, apparently. So these are little stories there. That how could a person make that decision? Where did that insight come from? It came from just the wisdom of peace and trusting in that. It was stories like that was why you saw on the board there. Never allow your learning, your wisdom, your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Because there was a person who hardly had any sort of training at all, except in violence, the black African soldier. But he knew that something was wrong, just he can't do it. And please always trust in that. That is really strong insight. Where that comes from, the ground where that comes from, is where the person is mindful and peaceful enough. You have to be aware, see how these feelings come up inside of you. And also have to be wise, you know, to be able to hear them and trust them. I did say a little bit, only a little bit, about euthanasia and abortion, and also that wonderful story which really solves a lot of problems for Buddhists who have pets. You have a dog or a cat, and you look after that dog or cat to the max. Human beings, when they have a pet, they really look after it. What happens if your pet gets sick? Well, you have to take it to the vet. And the vet says it's time to euthanize your dog or your cat. Then you get this terrible dilemma. What should you do? You're a Buddhist, you shouldn't kill beings. But you're compassionate and you have a cat who's really suffering. What is the solution? And of course, once you understand just how Buddhism works, the solution is to ask the cat, for goodness sake, just because that little boy, you know, could not hear, you can write things down and get his idea. Do you want your ears restored and so that you can start hearing things? Is that what you want? And the kid would say, no. Fine, it's your choice. Ask the cat. Unfortunately, the cat just, you know, cannot sort of sign anything. The dog can't either. But the dog can let you know its views and opinions. You know that's possible. So what happens is, I don't know if I told the story the first night, but anyway, this was, yeah, I think I did here, one of the long-time members. Dog had cancer and gave it so much care to try and heal that cancer. And in the end, so the dog just was so bad, the vet said, look, I've got to put it down, got to inject it. And she said, can I just spend a few moments with my dog? It's your dog, you've been with it for years. You love it to bits. So she took it aside, hugged it, looked it straight in the eyes to communicate with it. Have you had enough? Do you want to die? And she got the message back, dog didn't want to die. Wanted to carry on. That's what she told the vet. The vet shouted at her, called her stupid. And then she took it home. 6 months later, she brought the dog back. She made a full recovery. It's the dog's choice, the dog's decision. Even vets don't know. The same with euthanasia. Do you know what's going to happen in the future? I've seen just too many people in my life, 70 years of age, who should be dead a long time ago. They just make these miraculous recoveries. Too often you've seen that. So, you know, that death is uncertain. So no one can actually say, I'm going to put you out of your misery. So Ajahn Brahm, you don't have to tell any more bad jokes anymore. We've had enough of you. There's lots of doctors in here. I'm sure you can get something to... Now that really is killing. And instead of doing that, you know, you ask a person, have you had enough? Do you want to go? Just like the cats and the dogs. And the same even with if you are pregnant, you have something growing in your womb. How about asking? If that's only... Oh, I didn't say this the other day, I should have said this, that as far as Buddhism is concerned, that when does life begin? In the womb. And it's not at conception. Now, because you know, this, we don't know whether anything's going to be fertilized at that time. And according to Buddhism, now he stated, and I can quote this, that it's when conscious activity, consciousness, first appears, manifests, can be seen in the mother's womb. In other words, when there's enough of a neural network developed in the fetus or the embryo, I forget which, so that it can respond to pain or to pleasure. Before that time, it's not considered to be the human being. And the beginning of life is when that consciousness first appears. So if a person, a woman, has an abortion before then, it's not considered to be killing. No more than if you have a tumour taken out of your body, it's considered to be an abortion. Or just, you know, taking off a, I don't know, like a part of your tummy or something because you're sick. That's not really abortion. You're cutting something off, but it's not alive yet. And anyway, that makes things a little bit easier. But nevertheless, afterwards, after that time, you're one of those people like that African soldier. You're in a very, 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 very difficult decision. And because I've spent hours talking to women about to have an abortion, and they can feel the pain in them, and you have to be just a heart made of concrete not to feel that, and to empathize, and to say, look, whatever you're doing, it is, at the very, very worst, it's light, bad karma. I say light, bad karma, because the intentions you're doing it, you're not doing this heedlessly. I think it's, honestly, it's much worse if you see a sort of like a snail and stamp on it because you don't like snails. Because it's the intention, the power of the intention. It's not that hard and evil and vindictive. You're just trying to do the very best. That's also why, if it's real wisdom, if it really is wisdom, it will settle the matter. It will soften it and it will become peaceful. And of course, for the people who have committed, even though the word abortion doesn't really sound that good, a cessation of the pregnancy, then afterwards, why on earth do so many people feel so guilty about that? Good old Leha, she put something on the board there, that the hell realms are always having an open door. You only send yourself down there because of guilt. And the doors are always open. There's one of the wonderful sort of ways of describing things about the guilt which we have sometimes. Why? It doesn't help you, it doesn't help anybody. Sometimes, oh, if you don't get guilt, you know, if you don't punish, get punished, then I'll do it again. No, you don't. Sometimes that if the punishment is out there, you just hide it, you deny it, and you can't share it with anybody, because, oh, I'm going to get punished, I'm not good. That sort of stuff never allows any freedom, any... Okay. I've got time for this, just. This is one of those beautiful stories. I say it, I can't say I say it too much, I do say it regularly. But the last time I said this, no planning, just I said this when I was down in Margaret River recently giving a talk. And all the people there, they just were looking at me. You totally had them, you know, in your hands, teaching the beautiful part of Dhamma. It was a story of when I've given so many teachings over the years. And sometimes people take these talks and they adapt them. Well done. And they apply them in areas which I never expected. And they're so incredibly powerful. And this was like the story of, you know, the opening the door of your heart. But this was the story where it was a psychologist who started this group called ASSETS, Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. This is not just ordinary abuse, this is really full on. And you don't want to listen to what some of these people have been through. Just even a little bit of a... It just makes your tummy churn. And it's really gross what one human being can do to another. And the psychology behind that, I don't know, but the psychology of how you can take some of the people who've managed to get asylum in Australia, who managed to get here, physically they're free. But emotionally they're still in those underground camps somewhere. Young men being beaten, young women being multiple raped for no reason. Punishment? I don't know. Can't understand. But for some reason, the lucky ones make it to a place like Australia. And here, physically, they're well looked after, but emotionally, how do you get free from those incredible bad memories? And that's why I was just so pleased that people use some of these stuff which they find useful and good, and they put them to work. And this was a group called the ASSETS, and they invited me to go and see their place. I didn't know why. And then they told me when I got there, wow, that's really amazing. Because one of the stories which they use, it's supposed to be very effective, is the opening the door of your heart. What they do is when the person, the refugee who's come here, when they feel ready, they feel safe. You've got to be able to feel safe to get insight. In other words, you're challenging some of the deepest fears. And if you don't feel safe among people you trust, that's why 8 precepts, 5 precepts is really important. You know the place, you're around here, you trust everybody, nothing's going to harm you at all here. And when you feel safe, then they sort of sit down or lay down, whatever, and then they close their eyes and do a little bit of meditation. They imagine in the center of their chest a big heart, Valentine's Day heart. And imagine it there, and imagine that big heart has 2 doors. And those 2 doors open up, just like the doors behind me here or over there. Open wide, and you're inside your heart, comfortable and safe. And you look outside, and there on the floor is this little boy you remember, who was you many years ago, beaten, abused, rejected, stigmatized, alone. You see all these little girls who are you, young women. Why you were treated like that, you'll never know. But you were. That's you outside. In the cold, rejected, not belonging. That hurts. Big time. But then, you imagine a staircase coming down. And the stairs reach the ground. You, the part of you can live with, the part of you feel safe with, the part of you feel at ease with, inside. All these other parts of you are outside. And you call down to them. The door of my heart is open to you. It doesn't matter what you've experienced. Come in. Come in, come up, come into my heart. And you imagine just is terrified, little men, women, whoever you are. Just, am I really accepted? It needs a lot of encouragement. You walk up those stairs. When you get to the top, the big hug of love, of embracing, accepting. You are welcome. You're who I am. You're part of me. Little by little, one by one, they all come up. You can't get rid of the past that way, by denying it. Allow it to come up. Give it a hug. And then it can disappear. Little by little, there was a beautiful insight taken from such a little saying and building it up. And it works. That was an amazing thing to see. And the end story, because I should go off to interviews. The end story was this woman in Nonamara. I won't say who she is. But she was talking to one of the young men, the Kalyanamitta group, I think he was in. And anyway, just talking to him. And she was telling what she went through. And this, I was half hearing, oh, this is heavy stuff. And a young male Buddhist sort of looked with big eyes and said, that's terrible what you've been through. And this lady, good on her, she looked and said, you've got no right to say that. That's terrible what I went through. It's who I am. I've embraced it. I've let it in. And the way she said that was with such power, such authenticity. I thought, wow, that is just one incredible sort of heavenly being of a woman. It was all about just, the dung, dig it in. It's tough work. But that little story was a way of wisdom, an insight, how you dig it in. And it worked. And to see that lady, whoa, she was powerful. Not physically, but emotionally. It can be done. To see things like that happen means that there are incredible, powerful insights which open up different ways of dealing with stuff. Not to try and get rid of things and hide them, but embrace them and be stronger than them. Grow from them. These incredible human beings. So anyway, there's how insights, real insights, they don't just make you able to write books about Buddhism, but really be there in this world, connect with others, and solve problems, solve violence, and violence that has happened, how to make sure it doesn't happen again. Also to have these beautiful ways of looking at life, like the seven blind elephants, agreeing that human beings are flat. You can't get rid of a good sense of humour as well. And this is actually how we use insight to create calm and peace. And from there, just real calm, real peace. Solve everything. Okay? Sadhu! 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 Okay. Talk about all sorts of stuff here. Anyway, hope you found it useful and inspiring, I hope, maybe, not depressing. Okay, so yeah, we have the sutta class this afternoon and this evening. The bhikkhunis and seminaries. And just relax when you're doing the talks. You know, you used to be a school teacher before, didn't you? Routine, yes, so you know how it's done. If they ask wrong questions or stupid questions, tell them to go in the corner and stand in the corner. Get the detention. Or whatever she used to do in your life. Have fun, anyway. Okay. Oh, didn't do the arahant, did I? Okay, here he comes. Did we?
No.
Sorry?
That's for our sutta
class. The Arahant. Oh, yeah, no, we didn't do the. Oh, we did do the sadhu.
We did.
I get so excited.
You could do it again.
Nah. Okay, we'll do it just once. Sadhu! Okay.